Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, everybody. This is Ayanna Jones. I'm filling in for Kay Thompson tonight. You are tuned into the Kay and Gus show, but I'll be filling in for her. We're going to have a very special presentation this evening to honor the passing of Gus Henningberg, the other half of the Kay and Gus show. He left us 2 days ago. And so it is with saddened hearts that the GoPro Radio Network would like to inform you of his passing, an honorable man, Gus Henningberg. And this week, each show on the network will feature various memorial tributes to the statesman, consummate negotiator, human rights activist, and Southern gentleman that touched the lives and the hearts and the minds of everyone he met. Gus was loved, he was admired, and respected by his family, his colleagues, even his competitors, and of course his friends. And he will always be remembered. He'll never be forgotten. And he holds a very special place here at the GoPro Radio Network. He's been a mentor to us, a source of inspiration, a source of, you know, constant laughs. He was a wonderful, wonderful storyteller. He was a brilliant strategist, a compendium of so much history and wisdom and knowledge. And there'll never be another person like him on this planet. And when he left us, he definitely left, you know, a large pair of shoes to fill. And we have our marching orders, and, you know, as a community, we want to move forward, setting his example, continuing his legacy. My condolences go out to Kay Thompson, of course, the Thompson Payne family, the Henningberg family, all the friends and folks who, you know, he impacted in some way, shape, or form. So what we're going to play tonight is several tributes. And for those who don't know, you know, Gus was recently honored by the African-American Chamber of Commerce in New Jersey. And it was a wonderful affair. Folks from all walks of life came to sit down and be interviewed about the wonderful stories that they had about Gus. And so we'll be playing some of that tonight as well. But for now, we want you to listen to an episode of the Kay and Gus show where Gus was being interviewed and also interviewing folks, various folks from New Jersey, including Governor Kane and Larry Goldman. And just enjoy it. And here's some of the words of a man who was, is, and always will be great.
Very excited about this whole. You know, and it's going to be on not only for, you know, radio, for the radio, it's also going to be for television and the internet, or maybe television and the internet, or maybe television,
guys,
separate. But the excitement level is still high. But how do you feel about, you know, the possibility of doing this for, you know, forever?
Not forever, but it'll be fun. you don't quite know how much you know about how many things you know things about,
yeah,
until you sit down and begin to talk about it.
Yeah. Your name is down on the plaque downstairs. You know it is for me, aren't you?
But what's most important is the name is spelled right.
Correctly.
It gets spelled wrong more often than it gets spelled right.
When's the last time you spelled wrong?
Probably yesterday.
Yeah. Oh, really?
Not here.
But, you know, we really have to think of different other topics. You know, my head is swimming with a lot of the things that we can be doing. You know, and losing Alfredo Benitez and Wayne Gilden and whoever else we're going to get, like Eric and Brianna and Gina and Kiara and you got to and stuff.
Yeah, are we going to have any guests that are not
relevant? Well,
join us now as we look back at the life and times of Adam Clayton Powell.
They're legends in radio and television. With over 50 years' experience in broadcast journalism.
Let me ask you something. You are.
They're back to give you a closer look.
How do you react to all the hoopla, all the fanfare?
Well, I've got the flu.
The Kay and Gus Show, giving you a closer look. In this episode of the Kay and Gus Show, former Governor Thomas Kane, Air America radio personality Wayne Gilman, and attorney Fredo Ventura. And now, ladies and gentlemen, I'm here to give you a closer look at your host, Kay Thompson, and Gus.
Hello, and welcome. Welcome once again to Kay Thompson and Gus Henningberg giving you a closer look at different interviews that we've done, different stories, different topics, and all kinds of things that we're going to be addressing here on our new show. And I'd like to welcome Gus Henningberg. Hello. How are you?
Good.
Yeah? Feels good to be back on the air?
Sort of.
I tell him to give short answers, right? Anyway, Gus Henningberg was the former host of Positive with Black, along with a number of other things. But before we do that, I want to welcome also one of our other co-hosts, Wilfredo Benitez. We're going to get all kinds of legal advice from Wilfredo. He will always be here. We don't want to make any mistakes, right, Wilfredo?
I look forward to that. Thank you for having me.
Thank you.
Free legal advice.
Well, don't push it, guys.
Sure.
And Wayne Gilman, a former news director of Innocent Broadcasting in New York.
Thank you.
You know, as we all get carried away once we don't have jobs, right? But anyway, our other co-hosts, and we have a number of different co-hosts because of the fact that we are going to be covering a number of different stories. We believe in having co-hosts from all over. In fact, we really have co-hosts from here to Cape Town, South Africa, to Bermuda, to a lot of places in the Caribbean. And this show has been designed not only for radio, but also television and also the internet. So not only will we have an audience, viewers and listeners, locally, nationally, but also globally. So that's the idea. This is a new show. Also, some of us who are a little older, I won't mention any names, of course not me, you know, we are back on air because of the fact that we believe in getting another career. You don't get to sit here and do nothing if it's time to retire. So I kind of persuaded Gus to come on and do Kay and Gus. Notice his name is first, by the way. Kay and Gus show, and giving you a closer look to so many different stories. I learned an awful lot. You know, for instance, about this young man sitting next to me, he closed down Newark Airport.
Actually, I heard that before. Okay. In fact, I remember being a student in law school and reading a story where Gus was very concerned about minority representation, respect to workers who worked in the airport. And I don't know, someone must have annoyed him at the fact that there weren't enough minority contractors, what have you. And rumor has it, Gus, that you thought fit to walk on the runway to make sure that you got their attention. Is that true, Gus?
Yes, but it's a little, not quite that dramatic. Walking on the runway makes it sound like you walk out in front of an airplane.
But didn't you? I mean, that's what I heard. I mean,
he was a foreign object.
No, they have people whose full-time job is keep foreign objects off the runway. I was a foreign object, and I was off the runway in about 15 seconds. And you can't get to the middle of the runway. I was three steps out on the runway before I was whisked away to the clink.
That's the effort that I was impressed by. Think about it, you
thought
worked. To it. So it worked.
The next morning, I had a meeting with Austin Tobin, who ran the Port Authority. Now, I've been trying to get this meeting for months and getting nowhere. The next morning, after that little short foray out on the runway ramp, I had a meeting with Austin Tobin. So it worked.
Especially when you have airplanes stopping, flying from here to Washington to wherever place else.
I mean, you just consider as a law student, you know, you're thinking about how you can impact society.
You probably needed a lawyer.
You know,
at that
so it's really, it was good to see that, you know, with your own personal actions, that things certainly come out of it. So, you know, as a law student, it was just really refreshing and rewarding to see that because you consider, you know, there aren't many, I believe, people out there who can really serve as role models. And for a long time, guys, I remember, you know, growing up in Harlem, New York City, watching your show. My mother raised four boys by herself and really looking at you as a role model, even on TV. So you've had an impact on me even when I was younger. So to come to law school and still hear about you, it was really fantastic. So
now let's be fair. You're as old as I am.
Gosh, you wish.
No, let's create the impression that somehow I'm so much older than you.
Stop, Gus.
I'm not.
Well, that makes me the youngest in the bunch here. I'm flattered to hear that. But as you mentioned this particular instance at the airport, I'm reminded of the protests, a series of protests, demonstrations that the Reverend Al Sharpton used to conduct. And I guess what you did sort of like predated what he did with the days of outrage, sitting in subway stations. When was the Newark protest that you conducted? What year was that?
It was in the 1900s. I don't remember.
Really?
But let me tell you this good story. I have several grandchildren, one of whom is about to graduate, will be graduating in a couple of weeks from college. But her last year at Columbia High School, I was at their house in Maplewood for dinner, and she pulls out a yellow pad, and she had things written on this pad. My mother and father and her brothers and sisters were there, and my brother was visiting. And she pulls out this thing and she says, "Grandpa, I want to talk to you about something." Okay. She turns over the page. She had a list of everything that was physically wrong with Columbia High School. The tile is coming up on this floor. The window's broken over here. And she had written this stuff down. And I said, "Sugar, what are you going to do with that information?" She said, "Tomorrow morning, I'm going to put it on the principal's desk and demand that she do something about it." Now, I'm anxious for this child to graduate. And I'm not thinking that that's a week before commencement, that this is the wisest thing to do. And I said, "Well, Sugar, maybe there's some other way to handle this. Why don't you give it to the president of the Board of Education? Let her give it to the principal." And she's tapping a pencil on the table. And I know her well enough to know what that means. I'm tolerating you, Grandpa, but I'm not paying you any attention. That's what that meant, that table tapping. But I'm giving her a lecture about you shouldn't do this. And here's the point of the story. I said, "You know, you got to think through this stuff." She says, "Grandpa, did you think about it before you walked out on the runway of Newark Airport?" And my brother was sitting there. He falls out laughing. I said, "Well, in all candor, if I had thought about that before, I would never have done it. That was one of those impulses."
Yeah. Right.
But it worked. And 2 days after the little foray, we went to Washington with the governor of New Jersey, Austin Tobin, who ran the Port Authority, the chairman of the State Republican Committee for the state of New Jersey, to meet with John Mitchell, the then U.S. Attorney General under the Nixon administration. Now, I'd been trying to talk my way into some meeting for ages, but that 30 seconds on that runway caused them to decide, "We better find another way to deal with this." We flew to Washington, and when we got to the Washington airport, the flight attendant says, "Well, Mr. Tobin and his party remain seated." Tobin, who was head of the Port Authority. So everybody else gets off and goes into the terminals. Then they open the door and open the steps to walk down on the runway. And that's where we went, Tobin and the other people in the party. The big limousine sitting out on the runway at Washington Airport. Put us in the car and drove us to the Attorney General's office. John Mitchell was the Attorney General.
Under Nixon.
Under Nixon, yeah. Mm-hmm. And Austin Tobin made the most impassioned speech you can imagine. General, and the issue was Bernardi participation in the construction of Terminal B. That's what triggered all.
Did it work?
It worked, mm-hmm. Yeah. Tobin made this impassioned speech to the Attorney General, who sat there, John Mitchell, just wrote stuff down. And then he says to the Attorney General, "If something isn't done about this, General, we're going to have mothers with babies in wheelchairs and carriages walking out on the runways of our airports.
Was that true?
Well, I wasn't going to be one of them. I had done my bit on the runway. But when Tobin is sitting there, the Attorney General, John Mitchell, sitting there writing notes, finally he says, my people will be in Newark on November the 7th. This was in August. And my only contribution was to say, wait a minute, I thought this was urgent. Why are we waiting until November? And this was his answer, and the political people in the audience will appreciate this. He said, Nelson Gross, the Republican chairman for New Jersey, is running on November the 6th for the U.S. Senate against a Democratic incumbent.
Wow.
We will do nothing to interfere with his election prospects.
So everything has a political path you follow.
Well, that certainly did.
But there's another thing I want to get to, too. You know, when
but let me finish what happened here. Sure enough, November the 6th, the election was held. The Republican candidate for the Senate did not win the election. But the next day, 18 deputies, U.S. Attorney General, stepped off that Eastern shuttle from Washington and sued every construction union in Essex County. And to this day, the owner and the construction union is organized by county in New Jersey. The only county where there are numbers of minorities in the construction unions is Essex. To this day, Bergen. Go up and look at Xanadu if you can handle looking at for a minute. Lots of construction going on up there. We just built a new stadium. They're now tearing one down. There isn't a minority construction worker up there. And because they're working outdoors, you can see it. You don't have to get out of your car. You can go up and look. There are no minorities up there.
Shameful. You have to take a break. And we're coming right back.
I was going to finish the good part of the story here. All right.
We're going to take a break, and we will be right back with more. As a matter of fact, when we come back, we're going to find out how Gus got minority concessionaires, you know, to participate in duty-free, you know, stores out at the airport, you know. So we'll talk about that. So we'll be right back. Stay with us, everyone. We are back, and this is our new show, Kay Thompson and Gus Henningberg Show. We're giving you a closer look on a number of issues. I want to ask you, Gus, we were talking about minority concessions at Newark Airport, which was a result of your shutting down Newark Airport for a while and getting things moving. So how many minority concessions are there now? In other words, duty-free stores. How many of them are there now?
There are over 700 minority concessions in airports around America.
Because of what you did in
Newark. As a result of Newark. And they have an organization. Mm-hmm. The Association of Minority Airport Concessionaires. And they have conventions in exotic places. they've never been exotic enough to either go to one of them. But the point is, there were none anywhere else in the country before Newark.
And that
now,
happened
they're all over the country.
And that happened with Ed Holder, you know, as the owner of EJE
Retail, which is a duty-free store at Newark Airport.
And it's at Newark Airport now, EJE Retail.
And he's also in North Carolina.
Mm-hmm.
I started to say Greensboro, but it's not Greensboro.
And we don't mean to imply that it's Ed Holder now. It's his nephew, Janet Holder.
Yes.
And his wife, yes.
But it's still in the family, in the Holder family.
Mm-hmm.
And it came as a surprise to many people that there were virtually no minority concessionaires in airports anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
There was one at Newark. He did a shoeshine stand. And we sort of assumed, you know, he's just doing a service. He's not making any money.
Mm-hmm. All these things that we have been mentioning on the show we're going to be doing extended stories with them. Another thing I'd like to talk to you about, why did you leave Cos Black? What happened? A lot of people want to know that.
They got a new producer.
Oh.
And from somewhere. And I was over one morning, and he called me and introduced himself, said he was a new producer type. And we are going to change the time of Cos Black to 6 o'clock Sunday morning. I said, I'm not going to do a show that comes on at 6 o'clock Sunday morning. I know where my audience is, and I know where they are at 6 o'clock Sunday morning. And it's not watching television. And he said, you don't understand. This is not your show. This is NBC's show. I said, good luck. I quit.
So you quit NBC?
I quit.
I said.
He said, you can't do that. You have a contract. And I said, the contract has my name on it and my address. Sue me.
Uh-huh. Did you call Alfredo?
Not yet.
I didn't even know him at the time. But that was the end of my television career.
Gus, at the time you were doing Pop, did you appreciate the impact of any you may have been having on, you know, on people of color, particularly young kids?
In fact, I got there almost as abruptly as I left. I was in my office one night about 9:30, working late, all night. And I was expecting a call, so I answered it. And it was somebody from NBC. And he said we had met. I didn't remember it. And he said, how would you like to be on television? And I said, I have a job. I'm working at 9 o'clock at night here. I don't have time to be on television. And then I said, but what are we talking about? And he said, the show is Positively Black. Well, the show had been on for years. Eugene Callender, who was my friend, colleague, competitor. Gene ran the New York Urban Coalition. I ran the Newark Urban Coalition. So we fussed and we fought and we worked together. And I said, well, have you talked to Gene Callender about this? And he said, this is not Gene Callender's show. This is NBC's show. And I said, look, in our community, that's Gene Callender's show. And he has got to say it's okay with him. So we hung up. Then I'm sitting there, now it's about 10 o'clock at night, and I'm sitting there saying, you know, you say stupid things every now and then. And you do stupid things every now and then. And that was just one of them. Then he called back. He said, I talked to Gene. He thinks it's a wonderful idea for you to join him as a co-host of Positively Black.
And that's how it started.
Yeah.
So what do you think of what it's become to? I mean, given all those years have gone by and what it's been produced.
There's one show that focuses on black issues that was there before Pos Black and after. That's Like It Is on Channel 7. All over the country, there was a rash of black shows coming on, and most of them are now gone. So it was sort of a passing phenomenon, but let me share why they came on in the first place. President Johnson, after the riots, appointed a commission headed by a man named Otto Kern to study the causes of the riots in American cities. We had 63 riots that year, from Los Angeles to Newark, to New York, and so on. One of the recommendations that the Kern Commission came up with was we got to have black people need to be able to see themselves on television, not comedy, you know. And the stations were required to do black programming without sponsors. If you can get sponsors, fine. But if you can't, you got to put on a black show. That's where Positively Black came from, and so on. And so that was the genesis of it. Most of them are long since gone.
But what that has done, too, is it has diminished, you know, our listening to or hearing to on the airwaves, you know, things about African American history, really. Because certainly the shows that you've done and the shows that I've done have been people, you know, who are scholars like Dr. Ben, Dr. Clark, Ben Sertimer, and you with Adam Clayton Powell, and what, General Davis, you know, the general who received the silent treatment up at West Point, and Gus was the only one that had that story.
Mm.
I did Rosa Parks and other people. But that has really cut down on African American history.
But, you know, it's interesting you say that because for me, again, growing up in Harlem and city, raised by a single mom and on welfare, dirt poor and what have you, you know, it was just really encouraging to see those shows. And respectfully said, you know, I love rap like the next guy. But to only be able to turn on TV today and look at, you know, a rap show or look at something where, you know, I think a lot of kids today need positive role models. And for me, it just makes me sad that I cannot embark on my kids, you know, a show like Positive Black with a Gus Henningberg.
Yeah.
I mean, just any, you know, just having anybody really doesn't do it for me anyway, because I think, you know, you got to have those positive role models. And I just don't really see them today. And it's, and then you wonder why kids do what they do and why, you know, I mean, because like, a lot of kids are growing up without dads, so that's not new to anything. But, you know, I think if we have more positive role models, I think it can make a difference. Again, Gus, I said it earlier, and, you know, I give most credit to my mother, but, you know, watching shows like yours and Gil Noble just gave me the impression that being smart is not so bad. You know what I mean? And so, you know, I didn't have to go out and just gang bang and do silly things. So I really appreciate it, and I'm sure their kids today would appreciate that. So, you know.
You know, there's another thing that we're going to do. We're going to be talking about African-American history in the UMSAP legislation. Now, there are only two states that I know of that have passed UMSAP legislation. I may be wrong, and it's, you know, implying it's correct. And that's legislation that was written and passed in New Jersey by Bill Payne. And we're going to be talking to him at another time, you know, about the Amistad legislation means that African-American history has to be taught in school systems in New Jersey. Now, it's not monitored correctly, and it should be a part of history, period. And as a history minor, you know, I'm very particular about that. So that, and as a matter of fact, just happened to have this. This is a tape called Disappearing Voices, the Decline of Black Radio. Now, you know, our shows have disappeared. Okay?
This is true.
And this is Black Wax is the name of the company, which is also our production company. And thanks to all of them here in the city of Washington and, you know, his fantastic crew. And we're going to be talking about this. And we hope to have this as, you know, different parts on the Internet, I think, also, some sections of it. But this is really, you know, we've got to put the history out there. If our children are supposed to learn our history, it's got to be included in American history.
But, yeah,
period.
Yeah, you're right.
On the air, on whatever vehicle of communications we have, and everything.
But the Amistad bill that was passed is so significant that it's almost a shame that we don't talk about it more. I mean, it's not supposed to be a part of, it's supposed to be history.
Mm-hmm.
And the way the legislation was written was to incorporate the entire history, and not just have a Black History Month, what have you. So it's more than just, you know, it's supposed to be incorporated from the beginning to the end. And I think, and that encompasses not just, you know, African American, but I'm assuming other minorities and their stories as well. So I just think that that's something I look forward to that show, because that's something you should really talk about.
Yeah.
It's not being properly funded. And certainly in today, you know, when you see what's going on with schools today, and you have a governor, rightly or wrongly, because I know we all can appreciate that, you know, the budget's what it is. But when you have a governor who's just cutting out education, in my opinion, in such an insensitive fashion, and then, you know, you're talking about the achievement gap. Well, guess what? The achievement gap is only going to get larger.
Okay.
You have, you know, minority students who cannot afford to go. Yeah, you know, I just wish we were get on that topic sooner than later, because I think that's a very important topic.
It's a very salient point you raised, because what, as someone who lives outside of the state of New Jersey, I am just baffled about what I read that's going on here. You know, cuts here and there, and students are being victimized. I hear the music in the background, so
I wanted to mention one thing. Clem Price, Dr. Clem Price at Rutgers University, had used his own money, just for what was a $100,000 endowment for African American history.
That's great.
You said something?
Yeah.
That's great.
Yeah.
So many other things that we have to talk about.
Can't wait.
So thank you, Wilfredo.
Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you, Wayne.
Thank you.
You're supposed to say thank you to me. And I'm supposed to say thank you to you.
Thank you. What's your name again?
I'm Kay Thompson, and we'll be joining you again for a closer look, and Kay and Gus show giving you a closer look on and a lot of information, inside information. Wait till you hear some of the things that we're going to tell you. You're going to be absolutely amazed. By the way, Disappearing Voices, the Decline of Black Radio. You are going to be able to hear the address and where you can go and get this tape. Interesting stuff about the beginnings of black radio, where it came from.
Excellent.
And it hasn't ended. Thank you.
Thank you, Pat. Okay.
Hello and welcome. I'm Kay Thompson and welcome to the Kay and Gus Show. We're going to be talking about stories that you probably haven't heard before, and we're going to do them here at the wonderful New Jersey Performing Arts Center. I don't know how many people have been in the New Jersey Performing Arts Center, but it is a magnificent building and a magnificent institution. My co-host, everyone, Gus Henningberg. So, Gus, how does it feel being back on the air?
Nervous.
One word. And I know that we have a special guest, and you're going to be introducing this special guest.
People with the kind of background he has should be given 15 minutes to be introduced. I'm going to take 15 seconds. Welcome to former Governor Thomas Kane. This being the first show in this building is symbolic to some degree. When the idea was conceived about building a performing arts venue in downtown Newark, given the tremendous problems, racial problems in Newark at that point, a lot of people said, no way, you've got to be crazy. Nobody will come. White people will not come from the suburbs. Newark folk won't come. They'll go to Symphony Hall. You rarely heard anybody say, except you, anybody say, this is a wonderful idea. It'll be a wonderful contribution to Newark's revitalization. And we can all be proud of it. So here we are, X years later, whatever X is. The place is the central performing arts venue in the Northeast. And I fully realized how important it was and how threatening it was to New York. And some of the people said to you, it's too close to New York, nobody will come. So I'll tell this brief story before I ask you to share with us what you went through. I was in the police director's office the day before the grand opening of this building. And all the preparations were being made, and of course the entire legislature was going to be up here, and the big contributors and so on, and the then governor. And we were talking about mechanics of the parking and so on. His assistant comes in and says, they just got a call from a union in New York City. The union who represents the people who sell tickets in the theaters in New York. And they have advised that they're going to come over here and picket this. They're going to demonstrate to oppose the opening of this building. That's when I realized that this thing is threatening New York City. I was impressed with that. And of course, his comment was, well, what should we do? We mean the police. And I said, well, number one, you should tell them they cannot picket without a permit. Number two, you ain't going to give them a permit. And number three, if they demonstrate without it, they're going to be put in jail. And the young man who had brought the message to the police director says, well, what do I tell them? He says, tell them just what you heard. And that message was delivered. But the point of the story was, it made clear to me the opposition, even across the river,
to this building being put up here. They were threatened by it. Now, you got the heat locally. Would you share, Governor, with us some of the things that you heard and went through in opposition to this magnificent building?
You know, it's very hard to believe now. When we're sitting in a building like this, and we enjoy performances here, when we recognize how important it is to the city, to the state, and the region, for that matter, that most people didn't want it to begin with. Most people fought it. And the reason I was so determined to do it, part of it was when I was a young graduate student at Columbia, I got an apartment as cheap as I could, because that's what graduate students did. And it was around the area of the 72nd Street subway station on the west side of New York. It was an area that was then known as Needle Park. They did a movie about Panic Needle Park, because it was a heroin exchange area. Everything was cheap because nobody was living there because of the crime and everything else. And then while I was there going to graduate school, they started to build Lincoln Center. And all of a sudden, I saw everything around that part of the city change. And I saw for the first time how the arts could be a rehabilitative tool for a city and for an urban area. I always had that in the back of my mind. They could do it in New York. Why can't we do it in Newark, which didn't have a performing arts center and needed one? And so that was the vision. I first proposed it to the legislature, and it was the only time that the Republicans and Democrats united. The leader of both parties came into my office and said, you know, we backed a lot of your stuff. A lot of your stuff we didn't always agree with. Not this time. It's going to be expensive for the state. It's in the wrong location. We're not going to do it. So I went to the business community and tried to get some support there. The business community basically came back to me and said, you know, we might support you if you do it in Morristown or if you do it in Princeton, not in Newark. So this was a long, dragged-out fight. And I had enough popularity, able to sustain it. I got reelected and keep on pushing. And gradually it started to build the source. There are a lot of heroes in the story. Ray Chambers is one of them, but in Newark. Ray was the first person in the business community. He came to me one day and said, you know, I don't have a lot of money right now, but I'll help if I can. And maybe I'll start off something. I said, well, that's wonderful. Thinking he's going to give a few hundred thousand, maybe that'll be wonderful. He said, I'll start off with $5 million. Okay.
Okay.
Once that contribution was in, and we had started to do studies and started to show the legislature, particularly a fellow who was chairman of the Appropriations Committee in the Senate, who was a great opponent of it, how it wouldn't necessarily be a drain on the state, how this actually could sustain itself, how it might get contributions, how it was important as part of the city. We had to convince the Catholic Church that we had a piece of property here and they didn't necessarily want to give it to us, and that we should be able to buy that piece. We had to clear the area, so this was a problem. There were people in the city who didn't want it, just didn't want it. And it was a period of about 5 years, I think, before we finally were able to put the support together, a number of votes in the legislature, and this initial support from the business community, and so on, to get it done. But it was a lonely fight for a while. And then gradually, one ally, two allies, three allies, and gradually you saw the dream, so maybe it's actually going to happen. And I hired a guy to build it, Larry Goldman. I never thought he was going to run it, too. But he's done a magnificent job in both areas. And the important thing about this, the vision always that I had, that was shared by so many people in this community who believed in it, was that this was going to be something for the people of Newark. It was not going to be something just going to be, yes, of course we want to bring people back into the city at night. That was important in the white suburbs. But the really important thing was, from the construction on, that the community was going to be involved. Minority workers going to be part of the contract. That there were going to be a certain number of them working in the project, otherwise it wouldn't go forward. That the performances, when they started here, were going to represent the community and the number of people the community would go to. And that was the dream. And now it's become an art center that people all over the country come and look at now. And the question is, how did you do this? Because it's so successful. How did you ever do this? The answer is hard work. And a lot of people who tried very hard to build support, and it was like a tipping point. You work and you work and you work and you work, and finally you get it done. But I don't think I got the cornerstone laid until fairly late in the administration. It took 5 years. It took 5 years to get the support needed in order to build this place. But it's a great pleasure in life, Gus, to see dreams come true. This is a dream
well,
come true.
I want to remind you, it's not just people from all over the country, from other performing venues, who come to see this place. People come in here from all over the world. There have been people to come in and out of the building fairly frequently. There have been visitors from London, from Paris, going through the building. How did you do it? And Gail Thompson, who many of our viewers will remember, was the supervising person, a black female, from Red Bank, who supervised the entire construction. She left and went to Miami and built the Miami Performing Arts Center as well. And she comes back here once a year, and she goes through this building and comes away saying, how have they kept it in such good shape this long? It looks like it was just built yesterday. And yet it's one of the busiest performing arts centers in the country at this stage of the game. Very recently, at the Obama administration, they put a big screen, some of you probably were there, a huge screen up on the stage, and showed the Obama administration as it took place. There wasn't an empty seat in the floor level, the second level, the third. The place was packed. Old people, young people, white people, black people, Latino people. You sit there and you reflect, how could this happen when all these people were opposed to this thing? And it wasn't just in the street. City Hall was opposed to it in the beginning.
In the beginning, they were.
What about people in the suburbs? What are the kinds of things that they were saying as to, you know, being not necessarily in such a positive vein about the building of the Performing Arts Center, number one, and also having it here downtown New York?
Well, the problem, as you know, is that the majority of the legislature, even then, was suburban. So unless you can get the suburbs behind something, or at least enough of them, you can't pass anything in the legislature. So we had to form coalitions of people. And the suburbs got something here or there and so forth, exchange for that. But we were able to get, but to be fair, there are a number of people who became very enlightened on the subject, who said, all right, it might not be our hometown, it might not be our home county, but you know, it's the right thing to do. And we had a study. It wasn't just sentimental. It wasn't just because I grew up in Essex County and because I love Newark. Newark wasn't picked for that reason. Newark was picked because we did a survey. A guy named Shaver from Carnegie Hall did it. We had a survey done as to where an art center would be most effective and be in a community with the best means of transportation to get there and be able to serve the most people. Not New York. It didn't count New York, just New Jersey. And we tried all these areas people were recommending, and the number one area was Newark. Newark, because of the road structure, everything else, the transportation structure, more people could get to the art center in a shorter time in Newark than if we built it anywhere else in the state. So we had the facts to support us. And we were able to convince a number of people. We had to make a couple of deals here or there, but generally, a lot of people really,
Wait a minute. You're not going to get over the deals that easily. I want to hear about just one.
Well, I remember the biggest obstacle was the fellow called the Democratic chairman of the Senate Appropriations Committee. Mm-hmm. And he was a good man, a decent man. But he really thought this was going to be, as he put it, he really cared about the state budget. He said, this is going to be a drain in the state. It's not going to get to the audience. We're going to build this thing. Nobody's going to come. The state's going to have to put $5, $10, $15, $20 million into it every year to make it run. Like the sports complex has become in later on, since the racing has not done so well. And he was convinced that was going to happen. And he was from Middlesex County. And we got some of his other senators, and probably John Lynch was one of them, people who understood what the arts could mean in a city, to really work on it. And we had him working on him from every direction. And I think something ended up in Middlesex County in the end, but not this. Mm-hmm. and we got, once we had him at least not putting up major opposition, we were able to really, because we had a lot of support in the assembly there. It was the Senate that was the problem. We had to get the individual senators, both parties, supported and recognize it. We had to convince the people, the Essex suburbs and Morris and Somerset and everything. This was for them, too. And they could come down, we'd have great shows, and New Jersey really needed a performing arts center, and something really needed a home, and all of that. So it was a 5-year argument.
It's only a small part of the story. We have to hear about the construction of the, what happened with the construction. Were there minority constructors? Were they on the job? And you can talk about that when we come back up. So thank you, Governor Thomas Kane. You know, we will be talking to you again.
I've been honored to be here.
Thank you all very much.
Thank you. Thank you.
And we are back. I'm Kay Thompson, and this is Gus Hattieberg. And also, we are still with our dear guest. I say dear guest because of the fact that if not for you, the Performing Arts Center would not have been built in New York, number one. And this building would not have the diversity, you know, of people coming to this building. We have the bands, we have the dance companies, we have the artists from all over the world. And the important, I think a major source of importance, really, is the minority construction that was involved. And Gus, you can address that with the minority construction people involved in building this entire building.
I'm not the guest. There was a great deal of minority worker and contractor participation. And it got more attention because of the attention the building itself was causing. We had one incident in the entire construction period, one racial incident. One of the unions objected to the minority contractor who was putting in new lights in the Military Park garage that was being renovated to go along with this building. Because he was working underground, he assumed the other unions would not know he had minority workers down there. Except one day it got very hot, and his people said, let's go outside for lunch in that park out there. Because the air conditioner was off down there where they were working. So all these minority electrical workers came out with their lunch, sat on that fence, on that wall, having lunch. The next day, the unions walked off the job. And I won't describe what persuasion was used to get them back to work. But among the things that was done, now picture this, all of you picture this. Picture Larry Goldman out here in the middle of the construction with a barbecue grill, cooking hot dogs and hamburgers for the construction workers. He swears that didn't happen, but it did. But the position really was, we're going to have minority participation in building it, in running it. And many of our viewers may be aware that a young black woman from Red Bank supervised all the construction on this building. His name was Gail Thompson. When this building was finished, Gail left to go to Miami to oversee the building of the Miami Performing Arts Center. And now she is in Dubai, building a performing arts center in Dubai at this point. Point of the story, she comes back here at least once a year, and she walks around the building. And her reaction is, how does it still look like it's brand new? How are you maintaining this building to look like it was just built yesterday? And for those of you who come often and those of you who may be here for the first time, realize if you look around, it looks like it's brand new, but it's not. It looks like it's unused, but it's not. And if you go to some of the well-known performing arts venues in New York that are old, they look old.
They're shabby.
They sound old.
Yep.
They are old.
They are old.
Yeah.
But I think we're all proud of this one, and everybody is welcome.
That's right.
The assumption, by the way, that white people will not come to Newark at night. But anything you can dream up, they won't come. Well, that turned out not to be true either. The school children won't get any benefit from it. If you come out here during the day at noontime, almost every day of the week, you will see five or six school buses lined up out in front of this building. Schools are being brought in. Children are being brought in to see the building, to see performances, to see rehearsals. And along the way, somebody said, we need a smaller theater to go with it. This is just too big for many things that could take place. Hence, the Victoria Theater, right next door.
So there are two theaters within the Performing Arts Center.
Yes.
Yeah, but that was the original vision.
That was the original?
That was the original plans. Yeah, we couldn't build it all at once because to raise the money. But you know, what people didn't believe we could do was the two unique visions you just mentioned. Because we want to do two things. One was, we want to do something for this community. This is part of the vision of the revitalization and the rebirth of Newark, and a very important part. And so it had to be part of the city. It had to be part of the community. The community themselves had to feel always warm and comfortable here, and they were part of it. That was number one. But number two, part of the revival of Newark was we had to get the suburban people comfortable with coming back into the city at night. And that was the other vision. And people didn't believe you could do both. People said if you do one, you're not going to do the other. And thanks to wonderful people in this community, and Larry Goldman, a lot of other people, both those visions have been realized. Because people are coming, pouring back in here at night, going to the restaurants, going to a lot of other things in Newark. Now they're going to see hockey games. Next year they'll see for a while at least some basketball games. And that's good. But it started here. And so the idea of being a community organization and yet also attracting people from the suburbs to come back into the city the way I used to when I was young. We did all our shopping here. This was the center of life for our family.
So this is really the catalyst for urban businesses then.
That was the idea.
Yeah.
That was the idea. And now we're talking, you know, expansion of the universities over here, community center. We're talking about a lot of other things. We're talking about housing coming in right out here. But this was... we forget, you know, after the riots, when we had to subsidize, when I was governor, we had to subsidize a supermarket to come in because there hadn't been a supermarket come into the city since the riots. And we brought one in and it made money and another one wanted to come in. That was fine. But this is a big piece of what I believe is the future of Newark, and I believe the future of Newark is great. I mean,
Governor,
I really think,
excuse me for interrupting, but what do you feel about, or how are the people in the suburbs now talking about the Performing Arts Center? How are they now? What are they saying now about coming downtown Newark? Are they as skeptical as they were before? Are they fearful? Or are they taking advantage of all the modes of transportation leading to the Performing Arts Center?
Well, you know, what's happening is some of them